Today is July 29, 2026. This is your geopolitics briefing for Macro Observer. In the next 8 to 10 minutes, we'll cover the paused U.S. strikes on Iran and the unresolved question of the Pickaxe Mountain facility, the erosion of Vladimir Putin's public trust as Ukraine's deep strike campaign hits Russian refineries and logistics, and a five-party Kurdish coalition that has opened a second front inside Iran. For the first time in 2 weeks, American strikes on Iran's southern coast and the Strait of Hormuz have gone quiet. According to Axios, President Trump ordered the pause after CENTCOM Commander Admiral Brad Cooper told the Pentagon that the Epic Fury target list was roughly 80% exhausted. That number matters less than what it leaves behind. Over 38 days, U.S. forces flew more than 10,200 sorties and conducted 13,500 strikes, destroying over 90% of Iran's naval mine inventory and knocking out roughly 82% of its air defense missile systems. Iranian air sorties, which used to run 30 to 100 a day before the war, have dropped to zero. This is, by any conventional military measure, a campaign that has done what it set out to do. Except for one target. Pickaxe Mountain sits about 2 kilometers from Natanz, and Carnegie's James Acton assesses it as very likely at least 100 meters deep, well beyond the 60-meter penetration capability of the bunker-busting bombs used in Operation Midnight Hammer. The strategic calculus here is stark. Cooper reportedly told the White House and Joint Chiefs that Washington faces a binary choice: commit fully to the remaining 20% of targets, including Pickaxe Mountain, or accept diminishing returns. Complicating that choice is a genuine intelligence split. Some Israeli sources claim Iran has already moved thousands of centrifuges and enriched uranium into the facility, while other classified U.S. and Israeli assessments describe no active current threat. When your own intelligence community disagrees this fundamentally, that's not a targeting problem, that's a strategic paralysis problem. Secretary Rubio has meanwhile tried to reset the deterrence framework entirely, warning that any Iranian attack would draw a response that, in his words, costs more and does not scale down proportionally. That's a deliberate break from tit-for-tat escalation logic toward overmatch. And the war is already reshaping the region's economics. Strait of Hormuz transits fell to 78 vessels in 1 week in mid-July, down from 174 the week before, and a July 26th tanker explosion attributed to an Iranian mine shows Tehran is still willing to enforce blockade compliance with lethal force, even as its conventional options shrink. Congress has approved roughly $95 billion for this campaign, and a withdrawal resolution failed in the Senate by just 2 votes. Real opposition, but not enough to change course. Historically, this exhaustion-then-pivot pattern echoes Operation Desert Fox in 1998 and the Kosovo campaign, where diminishing marginal returns from strikes eventually forced diplomatic recalibration. Iran's own pattern here is consistent too, burying critical infrastructure in mountains, as it did with Fordow, to offset conventional inferiority with geology. While Washington debates the last 20% of a target list, Moscow is watching its home front fracture in ways that are harder to strike but potentially more corrosive. CSIS researchers Maria Snegovaya and Dr. Jade McGlynn report that Russia's own state pollster, VTSIOM, recorded Putin's trust rating falling to 65% by July 12th, the lowest since the 2022 invasion. And that's despite a methodology change earlier this year that Snegovaya suggests was designed specifically to slow the recorded decline. More importantly, this isn't happening in a vacuum. Ukrainian strikes have hit roughly 196 sites across about 20 Russian regions, triggering fuel shortages and price spikes that are landing squarely on ordinary Russians, not just military targets. Building on that pressure, Ukraine launched a coordinated drone campaign in mid-July against Wildberries, Russia's dominant e-commerce platform, which processes about 4 million deliveries a day and accounts for more than 10% of Russian domestic trade. Confirmed strikes hit warehouses in 4 cities, and Pravda itself reported in June that over 60% of Russians now describe war fatigue. The strategic calculus here is about who actually supports this war and why. Snegovaya's framework splits Russian backers into a smaller ideological core of hawks and a much larger group of loyalists whose support depends entirely on economic stability, precisely the group most exposed when refineries and logistics networks start breaking down. Fuel rationing now affects at least a third of the population, and Belarus has tripled its gasoline shipments to Russia to compensate. None of this is forcing Putin to the negotiating table, but it is narrowing his options, especially around mobilization. Zelensky has claimed Putin is planning to call up somewhere between 300,000 and 500,000 additional troops beginning quietly in early October, timed deliberately after Russia's parliamentary elections. A clear echo of the backlash Russia faced after its partial mobilization in September 2022, which triggered mass emigration the Kremlin is determined not to repeat. Underneath all of this sits a striking data point about the state's own capacity. A Rosgvardia self-inspection reportedly visited only 18 to 20 of roughly 30 to 35 mandated fuel and energy facilities, found 145 security violations, and issued total fines of about $5,000. That is regulatory capture, and it leaves the very infrastructure Ukraine is targeting essentially undefended. Iran, meanwhile, is fighting a war on a third front it didn't choose. Five Iranian Kurdish opposition parties signed a coalition charter in Erbil back in February, 6 days before U.S. and Israeli strikes on Iran even began, forming what's now called the Coalition of Political Forces of Iranian Kurdistan. Fighters have been crossing into Iranian territory since early March, with thousands now spread across the Zagros Mountains. There have been at least 9 armed incidents since late May, including the killing of IRGC officers in Pav in late June and an ambush that killed 6 Kurdish Peshmerga fighters in early July. CENTCOM has reportedly directed about a fifth of its total strikes into Kurdish provinces, destroying more than 40 IRGC and Basij installations around Sanandaj alone. The strategic calculus here is classic overextension. Iran is simultaneously absorbing strikes on its missile and drone infrastructure, trying to secure the Strait of Hormuz, suppressing domestic unrest, and now containing a mobilized insurgency along its western border. If this coalition manages to hold liberated territory around cities like Mahabad or Sanandaj for any sustained period, the psychological impact would extend well beyond the battlefield, potentially emboldening other marginalized groups inside Iran. Energy operators are already reacting. Dana Gas suspended operations in the Kurdistan region in mid-July, citing drone threats directly. One coalition faction has even alleged Iranian use of white phosphorus against its fighters, a claim Tehran has neither confirmed nor denied. This whole dynamic replays a much older pattern, Khomeini's 1979 crackdown on Kurdish autonomy and the way the Woman Life Freedom Movement after Mahsa Amini's death briefly internationalized Kurdish grievances before fading. This coalition, notably, is moving with real caution, a lesson its leadership draws explicitly from what many Kurdish fighters see as American abandonment after the anti-ISIS campaigns in Iraq and Syria. A quick note on the broader map, sanctions cohesion in Europe is showing its first real cracks, with Greece securing an exemption, allowing a Greek-owned shipping firm to keep moving Russian LNG to non-EU markets, the first formal softening of EU sanctions since the full invasion began. That's happening just as Zelensky heads to Washington for a July 28th meeting with Trump, alongside reported discussions about halting Ukrainian airstrikes as part of a renewed peace push, something the Kremlin has publicly called premature. The shifting geography of power right now runs through 3 unresolved decisions, rather than 3 settled outcomes. Washington hasn't decided on Pickaxe Mountain. Moscow hasn't decided how to manage a mobilization it knows is unpopular. And Tehran hasn't decided how to fight a war on 3 fronts at once without collapsing under the weight of it. For the next 48 hours, watch the Strait of Hormuz and the Kurdish provinces together. Any renewed uptick in B-1B or bunker buster activity near Natanz would signal Washington has chosen escalation over restraint, and any confirmation that Supfik forces are holding ground rather than raiding and withdrawing near Mahabad or Sanandaj would mark the first real test of whether Iran's Western Front becomes a durable insurgency or another faded uprising. Stay vigilant. Until tomorrow. That's your core brief for today. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow with more.